Happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here as we take a look at climate and weather now with our weather guys. Well, I should say, I said weather guys, but I really meant weather guy. Steve Ackerman with us today. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison and professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And Steve, great to see you. John's off to California.
He's at a conference and wasn't so sure if he could get either break away or get a cell phone signal to be able to call in. So,
yeah.
And I haven't heard from him today, so I'm assuming he's gone. So we will put off all tough questions to next month and have him answer them.
Well, I tell you what, just talking with Tim Isley about that Armistice Day storm of 75 years ago, and then he also mentioned the Edmund Fitzgerald because that went down 40 years ago.
Yeah, right, 75.
1975. And I guess, what is it about this time of the year? Because there have been some real dandy storms that come up.
Yeah, there's actually been three storms in particular that almost follow the same path. There's the 1940 storm that we just talked about, the storm that sunk the Edmund Fitzgerald, and those were almost identical in terms of the paths. And then there was another very, very similar storm in 1998. And so I like to use those three storms to do comparisons of like what weather forecasting was like. So in 1940, they didn't have a clue that was coming.
Yeah.
And so it was a big shocker. In 1975, forecasting had gotten better. Satellites were starting to come online. So they knew it was coming. It just turned out the forecast wasn't as good. And so the pilots made their changes and it turned out not to be so good. But by 1998, the forecast was spot on and, nobody died.
Nobody died.
Knew it was coming.
They knew it was coming. What is it about?
It's that seasonal change. Jet stream is moving around. It's starting to get to the winter, starting to approach. So that November time frame and even in late October is the transition where you can get these really strong mid-latitude cyclones. We have real contrast between cold air and warm air.
Yeah, and then they're often pretty short-lived.
Yeah, right. They go, they're short-lived for the area you live in. The thing I'd like to point out in the 1940 storms is that's the same storm that took down the Narrows Bridge over in Washington, the Galloping Gertie.
Yeah,
so that was the same exact storm. So they last a long time, but they influence our area pretty quickly because they're moving so fast.
Wow. Well, as you listen to our discussion here with Steve Ackerman, I hope you'll join in with your own question, comment, or experience at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And we always like, if you've got a weather photo, we've had some real dandies over the years from people. And so I hope if you've got a good weather photo or maybe a question about clouds or the weather, and you've got a photo to go along with it, send it to our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. That's where to go to get to our page. And we can take a look at it and certainly let people know what's going on and hopefully answer your questions. We just went through a hurricane. Well, we didn't go through it. Mexico.
Yeah.
Goodness me, 160-mile-an-hour wind?
Yeah, they even peaked up at a 200-mile-per-hour.
Oh!
So it's really an interesting storm from a couple of reasons. One is, it just grabbed the news attention intensely for a while, and that's because it just developed so rapidly. And that's one of the areas in weather forecasting that really needs to be improved is the intensification of hurricanes. And so it was a nasty storm. People were really worried about what kind of damage it would do. Fortunately, it didn't hit a very populated area. And so there really, I don't even know if there were any deaths, or I haven't heard of any.
I haven't heard of any either, but I would not have wanted to have been around with a 200-mile-an-hour wind.
No, not.
Can you imagine what that must have sounded like?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even 160-mile-per-hour wind is crazy, but. And at sea level, that's a lot of, that's dense air. It's not like in Boulder, Colorado, they'll get a lot of like 100-mile-per-hour winds, but the air is much less dense. So it doesn't have quite the impact of air at sea level.
Dense in terms of the amount of moisture in the
air? In terms of number of molecules. So the higher up you go, the density of the air goes down.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
And then this storm, when it hit, or this hurricane, when it hit, there was a mountain range or something, that just kind of shut it down a lot.
Yeah, yeah, that helped rip it apart. And in general, when hurricanes go over land, they're losing their heat source, and that's the warm ocean temperature. So usually when they go over land, they die, they pitter out, and they, you know, rain a lot, potentially. But it must have crossed the mountains quick enough, because the good thing is it didn't get stalled. If you remember, there was a Hurricane Mitch back in the 90s sometime, I think, where it went over Mexico from the east side, so from the Atlantic side, and then got stuck over Mexico and ended up resulting in a lot of mudslides that killed a lot of people.
Patricia,
went de-intensified and moved on and is now flooding Houston.
And are we getting anything up here of it?
So Texas is getting flooding. I just saw some pictures on the television on the way over here. In Houston, I think it was, and also in parts of Louisiana. I'm not sure where in Louisiana. I hope not New Orleans, because that's where one of our daughters lives. All that moisture that's coming with the storm is now.
Will it make any of it make its way to Madison, to Wisconsin?
I don't think so. Usually we don't. It usually doesn't make it up this far, and I think it's heading, you know, more northeasterly than up the Mississippi Valley.
So it'll miss us. Okay. Yeah. Well, Mark in Green Bay has a question, so let's go to Mark. Let's see if I can get you on. Hi, Mark. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. Thanks for the opportunity. We had our first frost on the 16th, 17th of October. It got down to 28 degrees one night, 29 the other. But it was really unusual. I live right on the Bay of Green Bay, right next to the water here. What was unusual about it was we had two nights freeze without any frost, that the dew point was apparently lower than 28 or 29 degrees. I've been out here for 40-plus years. I've never seen anything like that, where it gets that cold the first frost and not have a frost.
You know, I was fascinated by our... We had the same thing. We had a frost out here. We live on the lake, the northern part of Lake Mendota. And, yeah, I had a lot of vegetables die, but I had no frost, which really surprised me. But I looked over to our neighbor's house, and they have no trees at all, so it's very open. And they had tons of frost. I was really amazed by that. On my other neighbor's house to the left, who have, again, fewer trees, they didn't have any frost either. So I'm not sure what caused the variability by us. So I'm going to have to extend that to what happened to you. But it was really spotty. And a lot of times frost is spotty. But this was really spotty. And, you know, usually you don't get a heavy frost, you know, on one part, you know, maybe that was maybe 50 yards away.
Yeah.
And then nothing by us. But it got below freezing because it definitely killed stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, and talking to friends around the area here, no one saw frost on those mornings. So I thought it must be a really dry, cold air that came out of the northwest or something.
And that's exactly what I thought, too, until I saw my neighbors. And it was just like, where did that water come from? So it may have been that, you know, again, since we're near the river, maybe there was some moisture that blew in and just stayed there overnight, you know, and made it just a real small spot. But it was...
Strange days.
It was definitely strange, first freeze, first frost. Well... First for us, for some, not for others.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. Thanks for calling. Actually, I was thinking about that. We had a frost, or a freeze anyway, and I had not gotten my lime plant, my lime tree, limey in yet. But limey is up on the second story, and just I think that's just high enough that the temperature gradation... 15 feet difference.
Yeah, and that was the other thing I should mention, that our neighbor's property was not lower than us. You know, so it was higher than us as well. But yeah, I had plants next to the house, indoor plants, and my wife was out of town. She probably would have brought them in. I forgot. But the ones near the house were fine. There was one out among the plants that I didn't see, and that is
not
trying to survive.
Oh, Jim in Lake City, Minnesota, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to ask about the year 1965 and 67, too, but 65 in particular, because that was a year of record snow in the Mississippi Valley overall and record flooding on the Mississippi. And it was a year of I remember the first week in January in central Wisconsin, there was no snow on the ground, and it was raining, and it was in the low 30s. And that, you know, the rest of that winter was just brutal as far as variations between ice and freezing rain and blizzard and snow and everything else. And in April, for the trout opener up in Ashland, you couldn't get near the water in the Brule. It was just, you could see it running bright red, but there was, the snow was so deep there that you, even with chest waders, you didn't know where the edge was. And I there was flooding the end of April in La Crosse, everything was sandbagged. And I'm wondering, was that a year that was affected by El Nino? As or, you know, I know that's a relatively new term, but do they correlate back in history with all the records as far as what caused that?
No, that was not a year correlated with El Nino. Actually, we do. We talk about El Nino a lot now because we've seen connections between strong El Ninos and different parts of the world. But we have observations of El Nino going back into the 1800s it was occurring. Mm-hmm. And the 65, 67 time period was not one of those. And usually, but I lived on Long Island. I remember we had a lot of snow on Long Island that time period as well. So it must have been just the right weather patterns bringing in moisture and snowfall.
Okay.
The bad thing about El Nino, and we have a strong one going now, is that generally that means for the upper Midwest less snowfall. That's the concern, at least that I have now, because we still like winters and snowfall. But the last strong El Nino we had was 97-98, and we had significantly less snowfall.
And when you have less snowfall, you have, for one thing, there's not as much moisture, and your frost depth goes down, and there are...
Yep, and it has big economic impacts, you know, for those areas to the northern parts of the Great Lakes, that Great Lakes states, you know, that have skiing and snowmobiling and, you know, rely on that kind of tourism.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Jim, for calling. Appreciate your call. We have some really cool photos coming up already on our Facebook page, and we'll be talking about them. There's a wall cloud photo that is absolutely stunning from Randy, and another one as well. We'll get to those. Steve Ackerman, our guest today, and I hope you'll join in. If you have a weather question or climate question, call us at 1-800-642-1234 or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'll be back with Steve right after this look at the news. You stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You know, there's never a shortage of things to talk about when it comes to the weather. And Steve Ackerman is one of those guys I think can talk about the weather forever. He directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, a professor at the UW-Madison in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And Steve, always a pleasure. Thanks for coming by.
And it's a pleasure to be here and talk about weather.
Well, I tell you, we have lots of calls and we have some wonderful photos. I want to go to one photo because I want people to go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. There are several interesting photos. One from Randy, who says, wonders if you could comment on this wall cloud that came across Lake Michigan on August 2nd. And took down thousands of trees in Glen Arbor, Michigan, which is across the lake from Door County. My wife and I vacationed there at the end of September, and they were still clearing up. Residents said the winds were 90 miles per hour, but no tornado. And that cloud and that sky.
Yeah, you look at that and you know, there's two things. One is that the cloud itself looks...
It's a wall cloud?
It's a wall cloud, or it may also be an Arcus cloud. What happens is... in thunderstorms, particularly in severe thunderstorms, you have this downdraft. So to support the air that's going up, there's air that's rushing down. And when it hits the ground, it could be traveling 90 miles per hour. And a lot of times it's called a gust front. And a lot of times you'll feel it because it's a blast of cool air because it's come down from up above. And sometimes on the leading edge of that, you'll get a cloud. And that's what it looks like it's getting here. Very turbulent. Yeah. But not bad weather associated with it in terms of being underneath it. But the other thing about this photo that people should go and look at is the green color down below.
The sky.
The sky. In that when those clouds turn green, that generally means there's a lot of water in there and probably hail, and you should seek shelter.
Get you know, the heck out of town.
Right. You're going to take pictures, do it from under a shelter.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, it's an amazing photo. Amazing. It almost looks like the tropics, but as he says, it's in Lake Michigan, so it's pretty impressive.
Lyman in McFarland has a comment. Hi, Lyman. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I have a question here. It's a rather curious observation. When driving to work early in the morning over the years through the neighborhoods, when there's a frost on the roofs, I've noticed that the frost on the roof of the house itself, there'll be a frost there. And in many cases, there is no frost on the unheated garage attached to the house. I would think you would observe the opposite, a frost on the unheated garage and no frost on the house because of heat being lost. What do you think?
So what happens is I love watching frost patterns on roofs, particularly mine. So what happens is in the garage case, let's take, right, where it's not insulated, the garage air inside is still above freezing. It's probably in the 40s. And so that air rises up. That warmer air is going to rise up and warm the roof. And that's going to keep the frost from developing. Because the top of the roof is going to be cooling radiatively, but the wood from below is going to be warmed.
Right. Okay.
And that's going to tend to keep it from reaching the frost point and frost forming.
So now with a house,
once you insulate that, that warm air that's in the house never finds its way to the inside of the roof to warm the roof. And so the frost will form on that part of the house that's well insulated.
There's also circulation in the attic, too, to also cool it off there, too.
That's right, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. I just couldn't figure that out because intuitively I would have thought the opposite.
Yeah.
No, I know what you mean.
And the other thing to look for, it just shows you how much I look at it, is that sometimes with frost patterns you'll see, there'll be frost and then there'll be straight lines separated by about 16 inches or 18 inches where there is no frost. And
yep.
And those are the beams.
16 inches, right?
Right,
yeah. Those are the beams.
Yeah. So yeah, it's fun to watch where frost forms because it's an energy balance. It's a difference between energy losses and energy gains,
mm-hmm.
and it just takes a little bit of energy gains to keep frost from forming.
There we go. Thanks, Lyman.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, that was a good another good question and comment. We always get good ones. Jim and Cable, your turn. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, thank you for taking my call. Yes. About 20 years ago, I was up on my lake property, and I was looking out my window, and I saw this sheet of water coming at me. I'm about 30 feet above the lake, and this sheet of water, it was almost like a tidal wave, came through and went right up onto my windows, and it was just a gust of wind that just tore into the house, didn't damage the house, damaged some of the trees. But it was almost like you could see this thing coming at you, and I was just looking at it, and I was just mesmerized by it. And then after that, it rained a little bit, but there was no really bad weather associated with it.
Oh, interesting.
So it's kind of like a wind shear?
It was probably I would guess a line of convection that was coming down.
Okay.
And to maintain those, you need vertical wind shear to keep them moving, and you probably have the sinking air associated with it. So it must have been a really narrow band, a very strong convection, and then weaker convection behind it.
Now, do you call that a wind shear? Is that and can it reach levels of wind that's going 60, 70 miles an hour?
So the way we define wind shear, it's a change in either the velocity or the direction of the winds. Or it could be both of them, both a shift in the wind direction as well as the wind speed. So across a wind shear line, you could have a change in 60 mile per hour wind speed, for example. But we don't necessarily always think about it in terms of velocity itself. It's about the change in the velocity, which means the change in the speed and or direction.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. And River in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry, and hi to you. You're what a guy. Mm-hmm. I'm was out yesterday afternoon looking south toward the south across from the north side of Lake Mendota up on a hill and just admiring the clouds and noticed that there was a lot of color in the clouds just under the sun. It was a large area. And I know sun dogs appear on either side of the sun, but this was underneath, and it was a larger area than a sun dog. And it was quite beautiful.
And what were the kind of colors you were seeing? Oh, I'm sorry, what kind of colors were you seeing? Was it a variety?
Purple and turquoise, mostly.
Yeah, so that's a... we see that in thinner clouds that are made of water droplets, and it's like an interference pattern. So as light waves interact with obstacles, they can change their direction. And then light waves interacting with two different rays interacting with two different particles can then interfere with each other and generate a different color other than white. You see this more in water, like if you watch water waves approach a post in the water. As they hit that post, then the wave goes around it, and then some places the wave crests increase and other places they decrease. And in the case of light, it generates visible light. It generates these pinks and magenta type colors. It's what we call a diffraction pattern.
Is that like similar to the patterns you see on oil?
Yes, exactly. Yep. Very similar to that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, and along the same lines, the other day, and I've seen this many times, the sky was like there was a yellowness.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? And it was later afternoon, I think, but the sky had this kind of funny yellow, deep yellow aura to it.
Yeah, we've had a couple of really nice sunsets with those deep yellows. A lot of times that ends up orange and reds. But yeah, and again, it's the sun setting and the air scattering the molecules, the nitrogen, oxygen molecules, scattering away the blue lights and removing all the blues and leaving behind the yellows and the oranges.
I was outside at the time, and the trees that, you know, we still have pretty good color.
We still have some good color, yeah.
Yeah, really good color, and it made quite a difference. It made that color really stand out.
It would make the yellow trees really stand out by shining yellow light on them.
Yeah. And even those deep red, almost fluorescent red ones as well, the aspens, not aspen, it'll come to me
in a minute.
The maples? Really, really, really stand out. Well, River, thank you for calling. Appreciate it very much. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Mary in Eau Claire, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for having me. I have a question about, well, you talk about El Nino a lot in the Southern Pacific, but I've heard of this PDO in the North Pacific, I don't know how to pronounce it, the Cato,
yep.
And I was wondering, what effect does that have on our weather, and did that have any impact on those, like, giant storms you were talking about earlier?
Okay, so now we've got Pacific Decadal Oscillation, I think is the PDO.
Right, the PDO is the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, and it's a pattern that we see in the ocean atmosphere that's associated with climate variabilities. The storm that we were seeing in the Patricia storm, the hurricane that we just had that hit the west coast of Mexico, is more associated with the El Nino-type conditions. So there were two things that they think really helped intensify that storm. One is really warm waters in that area, which were anomalously warm. Usually that area's got cooler ocean temperatures. But that, I think it was 6 degrees above normal sea surface temperature, and that's what provides the energies for hurricanes. And then the other thing is the wind shear. We were just talking about convective storms, thunderstorms. They like wind shear because that helps them rotate. In hurricanes, we don't want wind shear. So they're much bigger in scale, so they want to develop their own rotation. And so those storms had more to do with those conditions as opposed to the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which does affect our weather, and that's associated with looking at pressure differences across the Pacific Ocean.
Okay, I just wondered what impact it might have on weather here.
It does.
Okay.
I don't remember what it is, though. We'll say that one for John when he comes back.
We'll address it next month, Mary. Yeah. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Well, you can't know everything.
You can't know everything, right. Yeah. It's one of those.
One of those that escaped you for the moment, at least. Mark and Mequon, hi, thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call, Larry. I'll try my best to describe my question, and hopefully I can communicate it clearly. Oh, last summer, when thunderstorms were coming across the state of Wisconsin, I live in Ozaukee County on the right off of Lake Michigan, and we would watch them, and they would break apart as they reached Ozaukee County and our area in Mequon. And the local meteorologist would be explaining that was because of the dry air in our area and because of the lake being, you know, colder and then the air was drier. But then you would watch them pass out over Lake Michigan towards Michigan, and they would reform into big thunderstorms again. And it was just such a strange phenomenon that I watched it a couple times over the summer, and it happened almost every time, and I just wondered why that would be, why it would form into a stronger thunderstorm once it got over the lake.
Oh, that is an interesting question. So what time of year was this again? Was it spring or summer?
It was summer.
It was summertime. Summer.
Yeah.
So the only thing that I was wondering about is maybe not so much the intensification as it got over the lake as opposed to possibly weakening as it approached the lake. And so what I was wondering is, you know, since you live there, in the summertime you often get these lake breezes where you get this cooler, drier air moving into land. And so if the thunderstorm's approaching the lake and there's a lake breeze coming into it, then it's going to supply drier air that might cause it to de-intensify.
Yes, and that's how the local meteorologist explained it.
Oh, he did? Oh, okay. Huh.
Yeah, that it would de-intensify as it would approach our area because of the dry air coming off the lake. But then what was odd to us was once it got out over the lake, it re-intensified into a big thunderstorm as it was crossing the lake and then as it reached Michigan.
Yeah, and so where does it get its moisture from?
Right, and why did it become a strong... Where was this, why wasn't the dry air affecting it out over the lake? Why was it able to re-intensify into a big thunderstorm as it was crossing the lake?
So one of the things may be is that as it goes into the lake, the winds are stirring it up and allowing evaporation to add to the moisture in the air above it, and then supplying the energy again.
Oh.
And then as the sun heats it up, then it becomes just a bigger thunderstorm again?
I wouldn't say the sun heating it up, because it takes a lot of energy to heat up water. I would think it may be more evaporation from the lake as the air stirs up the water, right? Because that's one way to increase evaporation. Just you spread air over water quickly, and that makes it, you know, kind of like rubbing your hands underneath a air dryer, right? It makes things evaporate quicker, and then that provides the energy for the storm to redevelop.
Okay. All right. That explains it. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling.
It's a good problem. Something we should really look into a little more.
There we go. Steve Ackerman, our guest today from the UW-Madison Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Larry Mueller here. Join in. Questions or comments, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And we have several photos just to mention. Carl sent us one of a storm in early spring. It's a yellow, and that yellow that I was talking about. Oops, almost.
Yeah, that's got that yellow you were talking. It was really intense. And actually, it's an interesting photo because the sky, if you can imagine, I'm going to guess most people have seen this. And if you're working and you can't go to the webpage now, go to it later because there's some really interesting photos here.
Yeah.
And in this photo, it's very yellow near the ground, and then it gets oranger as you go up. And all of that is behind pine trees, which are shadowed and dark. So it almost looks like a forest fire that's occurring in there, which is really kind of fascinating.
Yeah, really cool. And then Darren sent a shot, looks like, a shot of clouds that are, it's hard to say.
They're like an alto stratus cloud. They got the, sometimes we see them around here. They're very dark, but they also have light spots, and it looks like the bottom is undulating a lot. We've seen that around here, and it usually means that it's turbulent. It's a turbulent atmosphere.
And then Daniel sent one. My friend took this picture last summer. Oh, this is in Arkansas. And there's kind of a mushroom-shaped cloud in the background. He calls it an anvil cloud. And they had tornadoes around that time. But the clouds, that's a really pretty, pretty...
That's a pretty cloud. And it looks like the one that's in the background is a thunderstorm that's dying out. And then there's also clouds in the foreground that look like they're forming. And we see that a lot, particularly in satellite imagery, where as one storm is developing, it sends out this gust front, like the other photo we saw, and that'll kick off another thunderstorm. And that thunderstorm will develop, and the one in the background will die down.
The intensity of a hurricane, Steve wondered, and this is also Facebook, does that change with the time of day, you know, the heating, or are the storms just too big for that to matter?
The storms are too big for that to really matter very much once they get going. And the heating, which really affects storms, is when it occurs over land. It just takes too much energy to heat up water in a short amount of time. So in the long run, I guess, it does play a role in terms of it's the energy from the sun that's going to warm up the ocean, but that's going to be on seasonal timescales. And that's why we get hurricane season now. Because the ocean temperatures in the Northern Hemisphere are reaching their maximum temperatures in October.
Tom in Brookfield, thanks for calling. Hi.
I got a question. In a period of about a month, say a month ago to right about now, this is the time of year, that the waves in Sheboygan are suitable for surfing. And what I think they call the waves on the Lake Michigan are called seiches, but I was just wondering what were the conditions that make it right this time of year that the waves are there for surfing on the lake, because it's pretty much they surf along the North Jetty, and then the and it's this time of year.
Yeah, being a Long Island boy, I was shocked to hear when I first learned about 5 years ago that people surf on Lake Michigan. But you're right, they do it outside Sheboygan, and it's this time of year because this is when we get those really strong mid-latitude cyclones, the ones where, that sank the Edmund Fitzgerald in the 1940 storm. So it's those storms that really bring the strong air, the strong winds coming consistently out of the same direction. In the summertime, we don't get that. And in the wintertime, then there's ice that's actually going to prevent the development of big waves.
Yeah, because it was amazing that you look at the license plates of the people that were from all over, and then you listen to some of the conversations, and you know that some of these people that are surfing are from all over.
It's a hot spot.
It is a hot spot, and a number of years ago when my mother-in-law died, we just went down to the North Pier, and the barrels were so big you could drive you could have surfed a Volkswagen bus through or a van. It was just amazing, but it was a very comforting feeling. But most people, also when you get out there, you have to have, because it's fresh water and there's no surface tension, you have to have a much larger, longer board to float your weight.
And you have to have a wetsuit on, and you really have to deal with ice, too.
Yeah, I have a friend who actually makes boards.
Oh, really?
And Jesse, I don't know if you're listening or not, it does some surfing as well. and he's also a really great musician. So he's got doing a lot of things going right, for him. Oh, man, I tell you what, it's always fun talking weather. Steve, thank you so much, and we'll look forward to your next visit.
We'll be back.
Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW, our guest. He'll be back. Tomorrow we'll talk with French culinary chef Jacques Pepin about his new cookbook. And then at 11:45, we'll visit with Inga Wischer from Around the Farm Table. In the meantime, thank you for listening and stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.